And a normal plane will fly at about 36,000 feet in the air. CareFlight had to fly at about 2,000 feet above the ground to save raising cabin pressure. Because they had no blood supply to my brain and the damage from being in the crash and shaking around so much, the injuries are pretty bad there. So to save that getting worse, I had to fly at 2,000 feet above the ground the whole way.
So and you're not conscious?
No, not conscious at all. And
were you in a coma then?
Yeah.
That's Lachie Miller. This October marks 10 years since he was involved in a horrific car accident that changed the course of his life in an instant. Lachie lives with a brain injury and chronic pain that he's had to learn to adapt to. It's set him on a path he never expected to be on, and it's been an uphill battle. Through grit and determination, Lachie has made a remarkable recovery and found community and purpose in helping others living with brain injuries. And he's just found out he's about to be a dad. Welcome to Young Blood, the award-winning volunteer podcast dedicated to young men's mental health. My name's Callum McPherson. I'm a journalist, and this is a platform for everyday men to share lived experience stories and show that no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. Suicide is the number one killer of young people, and changing that starts with speaking up. So let's do it. If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a thing. Help us reach more people by taking 10 seconds to give the show a rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you've got some feedback on this conversation, I'd love to hear it. You can vote in the poll and leave a comment on every Spotify episode. I read them all. Trigger warning, if you find anything spoken about in today's episode distressing, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
The Young Blood Men's Mental Health Podcast is a volunteer community service and we rely on community support to bring this show to you. This episode is sponsored by Ski for Life, a charity committed to promoting well-being and suicide prevention. They've been running their annual ski relay on South Australia's Murray River for more than a decade, raising money to support community mental health initiatives. You can find out more about their cause at skiforlife.com.au.
Lachie, how was it for you going through your parents' divorce when you were a teenager?
Growing up, life was pretty good at home. Dad worked away at the mines kind of thing, so 1 week on, 1 week off. When he was back, it was good. I spent time with him, that kind of stuff, and the family would. And they separated when I was, I think, about 14. Because where we were, I was living in Humpty Doo, about 60-odd k's south of Darwin.
What's the population of Humpty Doo?
I'm not too sure exactly. I know the territory is around about 250,000, the whole territory.
Yeah.
I think Humpty Doo maybe 10,000 on about a very vast scale spread out.
Okay, so a pretty small town though.
Not huge in the sense, yeah. We had a 5-acre block in our sense, and you know, everyone had 5-acre blocks and very spread out in rural kind of areas and that kind of thing. Yeah, then I suppose, yeah, then mum and dad separated, dad moved to the city kind of thing. But as a 14 to 16-year-old child, you feel almost abandoned.
Resentful.
Yes. As a child, you're going, oh, why is he choosing to do that with his life? That was really tricky not having my father around for a long time as well.
You're not old enough to view it that way and understand it that way at the time. So it feels like, oh, he's chosen another life over me.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case.
Yeah. It was really, really tricky to, I suppose, get past that for me for a while as a kid.
How did it impact you not having your dad around?
I tried to, I suppose, dedicate a bit to my sport, but then training tracks was very far away from where my house was. Yeah, so that was tricky in some stages, but sport was a big part that helped me not feeling good enough in a sense, I suppose, because my parents didn't have the time for me, but they had their own lives of change and doing what's happening there. And I guess trying to be good at sport helped me feel like I was good enough in a sense. You're drinking and that glow and a bit more of that come about as well. One day I said, oh, you know, mum worked a week and this Friday night I'm going to go out. And then mum's partner, for whatever reason, said, no, you're not going to go out. You know, you don't do enough around here. Almost going to, you know, punch on with him, that kind of stuff. And I said, no, don't worry about it. Just go to the party. And went to the party and, you know, had a few drinks, that kind of stuff, and to the part where I passed out in the sand and woke up the next morning, the sun coming up on the sand there. And then the next thing I remember, I woke up and the car's kind of crashed off in the bush a little bit too. And so I've obviously woken up at some point, got into the car and tried to drive home. And I've crashed my car. And I've managed to get out of the car, look at it, a bit smashed, reversed out of the bush there, and windshield smashed, the roof caved in a bit, the front bumper's hanging off, got a bit of rope out of the boot, tied around, shut the bonnet on all, and managed to drive it home, the back streets the whole way home. Went and jumped into bed, and then all of a sudden I get a knock on the door. Mum's like, what's happened? What happened to the car? Are you okay? Is everything all right? I said, oh yeah, I'm okay. I just woke up on the side of the road. And she's like, oh shit. So she got me into a car from someone from the caravan park, and I went off to the closest doctor's clinic, and the closest doctor clinic in Humpty Doo.
You were all right after that one, though.
Yeah, I was pretty good. I was physically okay, so nothing happened to me physically wise. Just the car was a little bit smashed up, but it was pretty good physically for myself. the doctor's clinic, and then Alita said, oh, you know, how's it going? What happened to all this? And I told her the story about the argument. So do you feel safe and still want to live at home and that kind of stuff? And I said, no, not really. And because I, you know, wasn't getting along with mum's partner over the time, that kind of stuff. And I suppose what felt like him maybe a person having some fun with some mates kind of stuff. I suppose for a kid, it felt like a person bullying him in their own home and that like kind of sense.
Taking the piss out of you.
Yeah.
And just, or not respecting you.
Yeah, just doing his own whatever he wanted to in the kind of sense where you'd sit on a chair, which he would call his chair, would come in and, you know, abuse you and annoy you and then possibly pinch you until you'd get out of his chair because it's his chair and that kind of stuff. So that was tricky as a child.
So you ended up moving out?
Yeah, so that was moved out at 16.
That's young.
Yeah, that was a big thing. That was a big thing to move out at 16.
Where'd you move out to?
So my best mate, so the doctor, was my best mate's mum. So she said to me, do you still want to live there? I said, no. And she said, do you want to live with me? So I moved in with them. And I lived with my best mate's mum for a year or so, for a couple of years, I think. I did the last couple of years of my schooling and I finished my apprenticeship there too.
Jeez.
I did my school's apprenticeship there.
That was good of them.
Yeah, it was very fortunate. This guy, Juma's mum, was my best mate, kind of thing. So we played sports together as children. And
what happened to your relationship with your mum and your stepdad when you moved out?
They're still together. She had a son together as well, so had a half-brother. Yeah, and that's their choices, I suppose.
So you did finish school?
Yeah, so I was very fortunate to do, like I say, a school-based apprenticeship. I'd go to school 2 days a week to do year 11 and 12, and then I'd go through to work 3 days a week as a diesel mechanic apprentice and to finish off get my certificate of education, and then to finish my first year apprenticeship, finish year 12, and then started working full-time as a second-year apprentice.
So you had your head screwed on and you had a pretty clear direction of where you thought you were
My dad had a trucking business. So he had bought his own truck. When my mum and dad separated, he bought his own truck and started up his own business to work his own way. So I thought, oh, you know, if he's got trucks and I could learn to be a mechanic, I might be able to help him one day and work for him in a sense and then look after his gear.
So do you remember having a pretty clear path that you'd thought out and a sense of direction of where you wanted to go?
Yeah. I thought, yeah, it's going to be good. Mechanic, you know, earn reasonable money and that kind of job. You can go anywhere in the world and get that kind of job. And so that was, you know, pretty ambitious kind of thoughts. I'll be finished this at age 20, 21, maybe get to 22, 23, and then have a chance to travel the world with my trade, that kind of sense. And playing rugby union at a representative level, I really enjoyed that too. So chance to play rugby union anywhere as well, that kind of sense would have been handy.
Do you remember how you felt about life in general at that time? Like pretty optimistic?
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was really, really good because I made representative sides under 16s or under 18s for rugby union. And my local team, the Swamp Dogs, I played for, I'd played juniors there and we'd lost many games all my junior career, then finally got to senior level and we went on and went undefeated through the season and won the premiership.
Swamp Doggies.
Yeah, right.
So what a name.
It was unreal, yeah, right. Because we were, like I say, 60K south of Darwin and it's a lot more swampy kind of area. And so, yeah, it was a dog's head on a crocodile's body, this logo was.
That's exactly what I would expect.
Yeah, so they're the Swamp Dogs.
So you're flying pretty high.
Yeah, so at age 21, I guess I'd finished my trade as a diesel mechanic. I was really, really enjoying that as a career as well. So,
and I know you'd had your first serious relationship throughout that sort of period as well, right?
Yeah, so that was really cool too. And so it was after, you know, finishing school, finishing my trade, starting my trade as an apprentice, I'd found a partner in that time too. And so we'd been together for probably two and a half years and that was going pretty good. I enjoyed that. We'd moved out to our own place as well. So that was really, really cool. It was really good up until the point I was working away a lot because my work, I started going really good in that kind of sense. I was working at MacArthur and Mine, went over to Wyndham as well, top of WA, had really cool opportunities there. And then one day my motorbike fell over in the backyard and when I was away and my partner at the time, she said, oh, no, it's all good. I've got Ruben around here and he's over to pick the bike up for you. No worries. I'm like, oh, okay. That sounds cool. It's interesting why he's around. And there's a message coming around about 10 o'clock at night as well from her saying, it's all right, you can pick it up while he's here. I'm like, oh, okay. That's interesting why he's here and that kind of stuff. But anyway, either way, I've come back and from the time away and then she said, oh, you know, I look to probably break up now kind of thing. So yeah, that was a bit tricky after, you know, 2.5 years of thinking it's going reasonably okay and then all of a sudden starting to work away and then she wants to.
So she cheated on you?
I imagine so. I can't confirm that or deny that kind of thing, but at the same time as this fellow was around at the time at late nights around my place when I wasn't there, that kind of stuff. So who knows?
Was he someone that you knew?
No, I didn't know him at all. Right. And then probably a few weeks after we separated, they all of a sudden started dating as well. So, you know, just makes you think there was probably a bit more of it going on before our separation between us two. But
so how did that impact you at that age?
That was pretty tricky, I suppose. I was 20 years of age and just finished my kind of trade. And then, yeah, she left me in that way. And thinking I was, you know, maybe had the person I was going to be with for the rest of my life possibly as well, kind of sense. And, you know, we'd spoken about kids before in different senses and at a time. And I'll say I was going to be at that moment, maybe in a few years' time. But yeah, I saw a bit of a future with this lady at the time. And then for that to unfold and go that way was tricky. And not to say I went down a dark pathway, but I didn't look after myself in the most healthiest way. Like from the outside looking in, probably would have looked pretty good, but really from the inside looking out, it was a lot of struggle at that time. And
so did you notice a change in yourself at that time?
Yeah, I guess she'd stricken my social life to some degree just because she was, I don't know, worried and jealous I was going to be the one out going and cheating on her in a sense. So I didn't really go out and do as much as I used to. But then, so I'm like, well, that's it. I just went out pretty much all the time then. I was still working a lot as a diesel mechanic and working minimum 10-hour days, but then still going out 3-4 nights a week. Early hours in the morning, and then a bit more drinking, you know, come about as well. And then working in the trucking industry, and it was easy enough to get any kind of drugs and different truck drivers, that kind of sense. So other different things came into my life as well. And yeah, not to say I was going downhill, but I probably wasn't living the best life I could have been at the time.
So what was your frame of mind around that time?
Enjoy the minute. So I was just enjoying for myself and not really caring about too many other people and much in a life, I guess, after me. It was good. So I had, you know, when I was earning $3,000 a fortnight, I suppose, and I was coming in every fortnight, $3,000 after tax kind of thing. It was easy enough to just
piss up the wall.
Use that. It was very easy to enjoy that over a weekend and being a 20, 21-year-old man. I wasn't really thinking too much of the future either, putting any of that away. So, yeah, it was...
But you're having a pretty good time.
Yeah, it was, you know, a good time in that sense kind of stuff. I've been enjoying myself to try and find whatever that next stage of life was in a way.
What was the plan from there?
I guess I had a guy named Grant that I got along with, a Scottish guy at work, and he was one day going to go back home to Scotland in that kind of sense. He said, when I go, come with me, Lockie, and we'll get you a job with a work company I know over there. We'll play rugby together in that kind of sense. And well, that's a really cool opportunity to go over there. And he goes, Europe's just only half of, you know, 2-hour flight away kind of thing from Scotland or whatever else. And so I'll go live in Scotland. We'll travel Europe all the time. That kind of stuff. So I'm like, that sounds like a pretty good time. Bit of fun as a 20, you know, through my early 20s kind of thing.
So that's where you were heading.
That was the plan, yeah.
Yeah, but it didn't happen.
Not quite. The day that changed my life in another way. So on the 11th of October 2013, I was working as, like I said, the diesel mechanic. I was at a company called Road Trains of Australia in Noonamar. And I had to finish a job that day, adjust some brakes on a truck before we went to go pick up some cows. So then I finished maybe about 6:30-ish, I suppose, and on a Friday afternoon, we're at the end of a working week, and so not to say I'm sleepy, but at the same time, a bit more fatigue starts setting in, and then at 6:30, the sun starts to set as well, and so when you're driving home, that change of light starts coming in, and then, not to say I was distracted in a sense, but I was getting ready for a third or a fourth date with a girl named Shannon, so I was really excited.
Your mind was elsewhere.
Yeah, really excited to see where that goes. You know, you're playing lines in your head you might be using to go ahead for the night, and see where the next things might go ahead kind of thing for the night. So a bit excited, a bit distracted that wise. And then there was a car in front of me towing a boat. And there was two cars in front of me. So he had a boat with a queen-size mattress in the back of the boat. So there's a car there and then myself behind the car. And the mattress flew out the back of the boat. The car in front of me managed to get around it, but I was a bit too close to the car in front of myself. I had to give myself maybe more room. Might have had time to react. But either way, the mattress was there and I hit the mattress, lost control of the car. Front-wheel drive car, the front left wheel sped off the left there. And it was in Darwin, it rains a lot, so we've got big rain drains and concrete driveways to get into people's houses. So I've gone off the left-hand side of the road, hit on the concrete culvert, and the car's flipped from there. So like a seatbelt saving going forward in a car crash. The seatbelt had gone this way out the car. See what's gone on my throat, over my head. The small scar down my throat down there, a bit tricky to see going, but that's where I got opened up. So from there, I was on the side of the road. The car rolled off in the bush. The main artery there, so I'm out on the side of the road bleeding out. The person coming off the direction, he happened to be my best friend from work's younger brother. And so this guy knew me quite well. He's jumped out of the car going, oh, gee willikers, there's Lockie Mill on the side of the road bleeding out. He's had to, you know, ring in the ambulance and some way kind of save my life to some degree as well.
How conscious were you at this point? Oh, you've been told this.
This is a hard part of the story, which I'm not sure of how much of it's memory from me or just how much people have told me. Same time, I've been through police reports. So they've got photos, just like photo leading up to the crash site, the photos of the car and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, so you sort of pieced it back together, but you don't necessarily remember it.
I don't kind of think it's a direct memory from me, kind of thing, just from the stories that I've been told and all put together over the time. And directly, I've had a chance to meet Michael since there and say hello to him and thank him as well.
So he called the ambulance?
Called the ambulance to get them there. Ambulance got there. Lady named Suellen Skinner. She's jumped out of the ambulance going, oh, gee, well, look, there's Lockie Miller on the side of the road. She was my neighbour for 10 years. So her eldest son was the same age as me and the same grade at me at school. So for her to get out of the ambulance and go, oh, gee, well, look, there's Lockie Miller. That's something she hasn't forgotten.
For her.
Very tough. I've even got messages from her every now and then and phone calls. We catch up and she'd just like to see how I'm going because she knows how serious my injuries were from that day and then I suppose the long-lasting effects I'll have in my life and things I'll struggle with in that kind of sense. So she just likes to check in every now and then, see how I'm going.
And she would understand that it doesn't just go away, something like that, for her and for you, of course.
Definitely.
So you perforated an artery?
Yeah, the main one down the right side of my throat here. So that was opened up. And that one there supplies the left side of your brain. So then from there, no blood supply for so long.
Typically, you split that, it's over.
Yeah, generally they say that's going pretty well and everywhere and there's not much hope there. So I was, like I say, fortunate to have Michael there who I'm not sure how much for him to describe to me and see me. But, you know, when I did see him, meet him later and thank him after he left, his brother happened to tell me struggled for him to see me because he could see me just covered in blood in that kind of sense. So took him back to that moment in a way. So that was
incredibly hard for people to respond under that level of shock.
Definitely, especially when you think about him driving home, all of a sudden he sees it all that. Holy shivers, that car just went off the side of the road and pull over and go, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That'll be a lot for him to suffer.
Great presence of mind to even be able to call the ambulance. And I'm
hugely grateful for that. And that's why I'm so grateful I had a chance to thank him and see him on that day. But from there, they found me giving less than a 5% chance of survival because I'd, like you say, when you open the main artery up there, there's not much chance of surviving. And so they managed to pack me up. And this was about on Bees Creek Road, about 60 odd k south of Darwin in Coolinga kind of area.
So how far from a hospital?
Reasonable distance, maybe an hour if you're kind of lucky.
So what they're doing CPR the whole time?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what they were doing to me to keep me there and around and alive and that kind of stuff. But they managed to, like I say, less than a 5% chance of survival, saved my life, rushing off to Darwin Hospital. And once they got me in there, somehow survived. And they'd seen x-ray, they did some x-rays on me and they noticed T7 to 10 on my back were broken. And C4 and 5 of my neck were shattered to a million pieces. Now, this happened, like I said, about 7 p.m. on a Friday night. By about midday on the Saturday, Care Flight had got ready to fly me from Darwin to Adelaide. Now, there's nothing wrong with Darwin. Love growing up there. Best place to grow up and that kind of stuff. But in the way, a medical facility is probably about 10 years planning to be the capital city in that kind of sense. So for the best chance for me to survive and be have any kind of quality of life after that was to come down here for immediate surgery in Adelaide.
A fair way from Darwin.
Yeah, 3,000 Ks. And so they flew me 3,000 Ks in Care Flight. A normal plane will fly at about 36,000 feet in the air. Care Flight had to fly at about 2,000 feet above the ground to save raising cabin pressure. Because I had no blood supply to my brain and the damage from being in the crash and shaking around so much, the injuries are pretty bad there. So to save that getting worse, I had to fly at 2,000 feet above the ground the whole way.
So and you're not conscious?
No, not conscious at all. And
were you in a coma then?
Yeah. So at the time, lost consciousness from the car crash side of things when the artery had been opened up. And from there, in a medically kind of induced coma, we'll say medically induced, imagine I would have been in a coma regardless.
Yeah.
then off to Adelaide and this is where they rushed me in and had Dr. Michael Selby, one of the best spinal surgeons in Australia. He came in and did the surgery. And so they took a huge chunk of my hip bone out down here kind of area there. And they took a big chunk of that out there to put into my throat there. And they put that in there because there's so many small pieces in my neck, they had to get a big size piece of bone to put in the middle for it all to fuse and heal back around. So it was pretty full on, it turns out, I've been told.
It's amazing what they can do though, isn't it?
Yeah, and then I should have brought them in today, but I've got the two rods and 8 pins that they removed from my spine kind of thing. So I've got big scars there. I've got them at home kind of thing. To have them
a memento,
a bit of a memento to survival kind of tool in a way. So I had, 2 rods and 8 pins down from T7 to 10 on my back to hold me together. So that was a lot.
So do you see it as a miracle? Well, you don't use that word.
Sounds
pretty bloody unlikely that you'd still be here today.
Definitely, there's so many words to describe, and had so many people as well. And My grandparents down here, they live in Peterborough and Yongla kind of area, up in the northeast kind of Adelaide. And a lot of them, she still go to church a lot, and a lot of her friends in the area, she always say passing on best wishes to me and that kind of stuff. And like I say, not to say I believe that there is some sort of afterlife and people out there kind of stuff, and that all helps part of it, I believe, is believing and believing in something and believing in myself a lot as well. And I'm glad those people at the time were able to believe in me and believe in something to help me to recover through this and, like you say, a miracle.
Yeah, it would have given them a lot of belief seeing you pull through too.
Definitely, definitely.
Obviously, you know how often people don't.
Yeah.
And they would have seen every kind of case and would have figured, like you said, 5% chance, there's no way this guy's going to make it. And then you have. It's interesting how some cases, for whatever reason, just defy explanation and shouldn't make sense, but yet, yeah, that's what happened. So, and thankfully,
yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's it. Very, yeah, thankfully and fortunate. And I say grateful now today, but I suppose.
So, when did you wake up?
I was in a coma for 38 days.
Wow.
I don't remember the date essentially of waking up, but after being in the hospital for 2 months, the old RA here in the old Adelaide hospital here, and then moved on after 2 months to Hampstead Rehab Centre after my coma. And I was there.
Do you remember waking up?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
I can vaguely remember people's faces in my bed, but not really any fluid memories from the hospital. A few little memories from Hampstead, the rehab centre as well, in that kind of sense. But yeah, it's not a lot. So, you know, months before my car crash as well, I can't really remember in a way too.
Yeah, so what had happened to your body when you did wake up?
Physically, after laying immobile for so long and not doing stuff, my muscles deteriorated a lot as well. So, I literally
recognized yourself.
I literally had to learn to walk again and physically do everything again. And it was crazy to think about. I couldn't even use like a lot of muscles down the right side of my body. So affecting the left-hand side of my brain, got a lot of damage that affected a lot of muscles down the right side of my body. So I couldn't really use my arm on the right side at all early. So
were you paralyzed at all?
Yeah, in some sense, like I had damage.
Nerve damage
in a sense, and somewhere, I'm not good at reading the fine prints and medical documents, but I'm not too sure whether it's the break in my neck that had some sort of damage to the cord, or whether it's just the damage from the left-hand side of my brain, in a sense that has trouble sending the messages down to the muscles that work in my body. So I've got like my tricep on my left side here works okay, but comparatively to my right side, doesn't really activate in a sense.
So you can't flex it.
So I can't really activate that kind of sense. Yeah. And then similar to like the pec down my right side, abdominal muscle down the right side. And then differences again, like my legs kind of thing, it's like my right leg's a lot more kind of tone in a sense compared to the left leg in a way. So then that's different
so
again.
So the signals from your brain to your muscles have been messed up.
Don't really work that well. And so early on, I had to literally retrain them and rebuild them all. And so it'll be 10 years coming up this year. And so it's a lot to get back to here now. But yeah, early on, it was a lot of repeated exercises.
What do you recall about facing up to that reality mentally?
I'd wake up, I was in ward 2B, and I'd wake up going, what the hell am I doing here? I'm wondering what my life's to be. I'm laying in a hospital bed where a couple of months ago I was a qualified diesel mechanic with a bit of responsibility to
had
me.
Had it all going on, and then it was just all gone.
Playing representative rugby, and I'm sitting here wondering what's my life to be, laying in ward 2B, where I'd press a buzzer, I'd wait for a nurse to come in. She'd say, morning, Lachlan, you ready to get up? She'd disappear for 30 seconds to 2 minutes, however long it was. I get this contraction, look like a crane and like a 4-point harness because I was in my bed and I couldn't physically get up. She'd put that harness around me and she'd crane me out of bed. She'd go put me into the electric wheelchair because I couldn't use the right side of my body real well. I couldn't wheel a wheelchair to start with. I could only drive an electric wheelchair down to breakfast every morning. And, you know, that was very demoralizing for a long time as a 21-year-old person, 21-year-old man kind of thing.
For your mind to cope with having your body in that state and still reeling from the shock of how did I go from this to that? And especially not remembering what happened, but now this is the reality. That's just got to be so hard to grapple with.
It was very tricky to get to the point of acceptance in this way. But then is, you know, after the few times, you know, doing that, knowing that, you know, this person is going to lift me out of bed, but I don't really want this to be the rest of my life. Wasn't the person to put myself here, but I'm going to be the only person to get myself out of here. So, yeah, that's when I started working hard.
So what did that work involve?
A lot of physiotherapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy was a huge part of it too, because I had a a tracheostomy in my throat there. So I had a pipe in my neck to feed me and to breathe for a long time as well. So that affected my speech and my voice box a lot as well. So I couldn't talk very clearly to start with. A lot of people say that's probably why I talk so much now, to try and catch up all the time that I wasn't talking. But then, so, you know, often you wouldn't be able to be heard, couldn't speak clearly. So you have to repeat yourself 4, 5, 6 times over. And then after a while, people can't hear you. You alert, think, what's the point of talking? Yeah. They're not going to be able to understand you. Then all of a sudden you start going within yourself. Negative thought coming in, and you're your own worst enemy, your worst critic sometimes. And so those spiraling thoughts kept going without being able to talk to them, because I physically couldn't. And if I tried, they wouldn't be able to understand me. Yeah, so that was,
had the sensation of really being trapped within yourself.
Physically and mentally, because, like, you know, I'm having to rely on anybody to do anything physically or to get out of this chair or move anywhere, apart from driving the stick to move myself around. It was really
feeling
tricky.
Like a burden.
Yeah, and a huge burden as well for a long time for a lot of people. Which was, it was tricky. I suppose being a, you know, I suppose I moved out of home at 16 and was independent for a long time to some degree. So to be...
Yeah, a very industrious young man who had a lot going on and were very much running your own race to can't do anything for yourself at all. Did you have hope at that time?
Yes. Yes and no. Like, I suppose, like I say, I was thinking the only one that was going to get myself out of there, but I didn't know where that was to. I was fortunate enough to meet a young fella in there. So I was a 21-year-old man who had just been finished my trade as a qualified diesel mechanic. There was an 18-year-old boy in there, and he was an apprentice diesel mechanic at the time, and he had a car crash on the way from trade school, and we were both in there at the same time. The brain injury ward is generally a lot of older people in there, and so from strokes, heart attacks, those kind of things, which is fair enough, that's what it is. But for someone like myself, it was a bit trickier to connect with them, I suppose, and relate in their stories of life. And so when I came across this young fellow, I met him. He was in an electric wheelchair as well, an apprentice diesel mechanic, a young boy, liked cars.
Yeah.
We got along really well.
What are the chances?
Yeah, and so that was a huge part that helped me get forward and keep moving in a way. And at the time, I suppose a lot of people started saying, YOLO, you only live once kind of thing. And, and so we had both had near-death experiences, should have been dead, died on operating tables, that kind of stuff. So we can't say that anymore. So what do we do? All right, YOLO, you only live twice. So we went out and made up our own things. So we got our own hats and our own singlets made up, so that we had our own motivation in a sense.
Still rocking it today.
That was our own light kind of thing to keep us moving.
You only
get us
twice.
Out. That's it. In a sense of, not the way you're going to go and do risky things, but like, here's our second chance at life. That's how cool is this?
Yeah, so trying to reframe it like that you're looking at it, because you can't change the reality. You can only change how you're viewing it.
Yeah, it's a second chance in life.
So what did that do for you and your mentality? Because it would have taken an awful lot of strength to drag yourself through what you've been through.
It was a lot. And especially there was one of the last times before I left there at Hampstead, there was a lady in the room next to me after I moved out of the room 18 from the closest to the nurse station. I moved further away and was getting better and closer to getting out. There was a lady I'd listened to every night who had grown herself to sleep. And that was her to sleep. And in that time before I left, she got out of there, but she didn't go home. She went to a nursing home where she'd spend the rest of her life. And I think how sad that is for her.
Yeah.
And I think I'm one of the lucky ones. I got to walk out of there. I'm very fortunate in my sense. And so that's where I suppose, use that as a motivation to try and live on for all those unfortunate people that don't get to live on as much as I have.
You've still got all this life within you.
I'm very fortunate in that kind of sense. And seeing other people who aren't as fortunate as me, in that kind of sense. So I try to make the most of all my opportunities now and live twice kind of thing. So, different.
And someone who's been where you've been can understand that like no one else can, you know. You've been in a situation where odds on you shouldn't have survived, but somehow you have, and have been able to get back to this point where you are now through 10 years of work, you know, and now you can function like you can, you can talk like you can, and you can smile and laugh like you can, and you can help other people as well.
It's been really cool.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I'm very fortunate and grateful for that. And someone who I met early on in my recovery was a fellow named Ross Guy, and he was an outpatient exercise physiologist at Hampstead Rehab Centre. And when I left the inpatient to outpatient exercise part, he was in the community and went and visited me at a gym once a fortnight and helped me keep moving and kept me motivated to keep pushing on my recovery and gave me the strength to go every day, twice a day for the first 18 months of my recovery to try and get back to the physical fitness I can be. And he gave me the goal as well to, you know, why don't I try to run the City to Bay? I said, all right, why not? Set the goal for myself and gave it a go. And so 11 months after the car crash, I broke my back and breaking my neck. And in only early on in my recovery, first time walking 10 meters, taking me 42 seconds, the equivalent of doing 100 meters in 7 minutes kind of thing. I went out and ran the City to Bay and did that in an hour and 18 minutes.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. I was really impressed with that. And I was very happy with, you know, someone like Ross who managed to help me out and help me stay motivated and keep training through it all and get a part of that. And even to the degree I did the City to Bay the year after as well and did an hour and 2 minutes to try and beat it again. And yeah, I was really happy with that kind of thing. And yeah, it was really cool to have the exercise as part of my recovery, I think.
So how did all of that training and then the end result change the way that you thought about yourself and saw yourself?
I found like having goals set in my recovery has been a good part to have there in a way to keep me moving and motivated in a sense. But at the same time, a lot of time I have very ambitious goals, people always say, and I had so many goals that I have achieved, but I've got more goals that I can't count that I haven't achieved in that sense. But that's okay, because in the sense where, you know, I set my goals up here and then if I hit somewhere around here, I'm happy with that. And not to say I'm disappointed either, and I'm not saying I could have got higher, but I'm really happy with where I got, because I managed to get out, give it a go and believe myself to have a go at whatever that goal was.
Aim for the stars, land on the moon.
Exactly, man. Exactly. So, and that's been really, really cool for me.
So having those incremental goals and a lot of them and achieving them bit by bit, that's been really key to keeping you going and keeping your mindset healthy.
Yeah, definitely. And I found one part of it probably was thinking early on my first goal, I achieved it and I thought, you know, maybe that's the part where I'd be happy and then all of a sudden it'll be done kind of stuff and everything's better again. But then I realized, all right, now what's next? I've got to set another goal and do that kind of stuff.
It's always another mountain to climb.
Yeah. And then I'm not less always letting that kind of get to me going, oh, no, I've achieved the goal. What now? Kind of thing. But I'm going, all right, cool. I've done that goal. Now I can go and choose some other cool goal now and let's go choose the next goal and then go choose the next thing. And
yeah, and, using and also like learning to be able to celebrate it along the way.
Yeah, that too.
And not like waiting to be happy till you achieve this or that, because you never get there.
No,
you're already doing it.
Yep. And that's it. Enjoying the walk or the journey, whatever it is, to that achievement point kind of stuff. And don't think that you can only be happy when I get there or only be happy when this happens.
Because there keeps moving as well.
It does. It's always moving. It's never going to stop moving. So yeah, trying to always find the joys in every moment, whatever it is kind of sense.
And has that been a skill for you that you've had to work on, finding
gratitude,
the joy?
Yeah. It has been tricky at times. And one thing I suppose I've learned to realize is appreciating the good times and the gratitude that when I have them as well and that kind of stuff and be grateful for it and let myself appreciate them too for that time, whether it be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, a day or however long, let myself have that time to appreciate the achievement or whatever that goal is. And then, you know, park it aside and put it aside, all right, let's go do the next part of it kind of thing. In a way where I think of emotions on like a scale to some degree where it's like, you know, I can be at the highest point of the emotion here or the lowest point of the emotion there, but finding ways to get myself through that, the next part of whatever the emotion is kind of thing. So I am feeling happy at the highest point, knowing how I got there as well and remembering how I got to those points there and having those trigger points myself. So when I'm feeling down in times, I can use those other trigger points to remember how I get myself back up onto the good times of scale.
You've had to develop a really deep understanding of yourself and your psyche and how you work to try to manage this. I mean, we all need to do that, whether you've got a disability or not, but it's not just something that you just have. You've got to work on it.
It's been very tricky looking under the cover to some degree. What things are you hiding? And it's not from the world, it's hiding from yourself that you're not willing to deal with or grow forward with that kind of thing.
It's not comfortable.
Yeah.
Can you name what some of those things have been?
Yeah, I suppose like I was talking about earlier, not feeling good enough in life full stop. And then, you know, relating it back to possibly thinking that maybe it's because my father, I didn't see it as him as much. And then my mum, how she, I moved out of home from 16 kind of thing, and thinking I wasn't good enough for them or good enough for that part of that family kind of stuff. But knowing that's not the truth kind of thing, it's not me and that kind of stuff. And talking with psychologists and ways learning to deal with that, I am good enough. And then that's, you know, it's probably on them in a sense, I suppose, and try to think about how I can help myself and think about that kind of ways. And yeah, I found different strategies to help myself, to pull myself out of those depressions and senses too. And helping with psychologist talk has helped, chatting with someone a lot.
I suppose you've got a lot of evidence of all the times where you were pretty down in the dumps and you managed to come out of it. I mean, you're the ultimate example of that, really. So once you've got that evidence, of course, you're human, you're still living every day and there's ups and downs all the time, but you've got all these times that before where it's been real bad and you've had other times that have followed where you've been really happy. So you know it's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you do emerge an incredibly strong person in a sort of, and a grateful person in a way that it'd be hard for anyone else who hasn't been through such a traumatic time to be able to be like.
And I try to say that to people, because often I tell people, I go see, oh, you know, they ask you, what did you do for work? Oh, I can't work, I had a car crash, and that kind of stuff has changed my life forever. And they, oh, I've had a car crash too, and they tell their story usually before they've heard mine. And then they say, oh, you know, whatever it is. And then I tell them my story. Oh, my story is nothing like yours. And they always say my story is a lot worse off, and they try to decredit themselves. And that's what I try to say to everyone, that everyone's story is individual and it affects everyone in a different way, that kind of sense. Just because my car crash story, my physical injuries sound worse than them, doesn't mean that their story hasn't affected them in a way. And don't try to take away from yourself and whatever it is by hearing someone else's story and thinking that you're not good enough.
We do that naturally, don't we? Too easily. Well, it's not as bad as that person's, therefore it's not valid, therefore I should just shut up and not complain about it.
Definitely.
But it's all relative. And if you've experienced something and it's had that effect on you, it's made you feel those emotions and it's limited your life, then it is relevant and it is worth something.
Definitely.
Yeah.
That's what I try to like to share with people and talk with them and try to at least give them that space back, because quite often people give me space to speak and listen to me. And when they share their story, and often they feel like they, like people say, shut themselves down, like they're not good enough to share their story. I try to give them that validation and do it, because like we say, everyone's story matters and everyone's affects everyone differently in that kind of sense. And no one's is worse or better off than any other story kind of sense. So yeah.
Yeah. They all have value and meaning, and people are worthy.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So what can't you do now that you used to be able to do?
Well, the big part now, I suppose, after my brain injury, I have like a traumatic brain injury effect from it all now. So with no blood supply to my brain for so long and the coma for 38 days, it's affected a lot of parts. So my mental fatigue is a huge part of it. So I have big concentration issues. So I tried to get back into work in a sense at a Repco store to start with, because I was a diesel mechanic before. Having automotive understandings might be pretty good for me. It got to the point where I could do a 4-hour shift kind of thing with a 1/2-hour break in the middle. You know, the average paid person has to do 5 hours before they get a paid break in that kind of sense. I couldn't get to that point of even volunteering. And then when I was doing that for an hour or so, my concentration would lapse. I'd forget how to do stuff. I couldn't remember where parts had gone on shelves. And all the time I have to ask people all the time for different reassurance to redo things, key entering for computer tasks, that kind of stuff. And it was as much as I wanted to.
So that level of detail you have trouble with.
As much as I wanted to, I couldn't have trouble remembering the steps of stuff. And a lot of them, I see words on papers and I have trouble reading. You know, it's an embarrassing thing. I have a lot of trouble reading and writing as well, I think. So you know, I read information and sometimes I can read the first few lines and I get down to maybe the third or fourth line and I've forgotten what the first few lines of the top were, and I have to try to reread them. And then the struggle of me trying to read them.
Frustrating.
And then like trying to read through every single letter to try and work out what that word actually is. And I work out what the word is. And I'm like, oh, what's the sentence I'm just reading? Oh, never mind. And then, so that's been tricky in a different sense again.
So you can't work.
No. So yeah, that's been really, really hard for me to try and return back to, you know, a normal job or any kind of paid employment that would fit without having so much monitoring going on with me or someone ticking over my shoulder every few seconds to watch what I'm doing. So it wasn't very viable for the companies that I was volunteering at to have me on as a paid employee, which was very hard to hear at the time when you're a grown adult who thinks they can do stuff and pretty good. And they have to tell you that, you know, as great as a person you are to have around the company and hang around with and share with kind of stuff, we can't physically get the justification of paying you because you're not worth the money in a sense. And saying it in kinder words than that, but it's hard to hear that.
Especially when you were so capable beforehand and you're bloody good at it.
Yeah, a 21-year-old man thinking you've got the world at your feet and everything there to go with. I mean, huge struggles and having to try and reinvent yourself again. It's been very tricky in a way.
So what options are there available to you?
Well, I've gotten out into, like I say, the volunteering at the automotive stores didn't quite work out, but I get out into the disability community a bit now and have a chance to hang out in different spaces there. So place called Brain Injury SA, they do different support groups. And so often I get the opportunity to go to these support groups and participate in them. And you get different people with all different diverse injuries of kinds who've just newly acquired them, and they've come into these spaces and groups and asking questions. And sometimes the therapists don't have all the answers, and it's a bit easier to understand coming from a person with lived experience. So now, coming up to nearly 10 years of my injury, I can share with these people my stories and things I've done to overcome the hurdles that they're having now, and save them to having to reinvent the wheel, in a sense. They can take my ideas and slightly modify it.
You've already been there and done that.
Probably modified to fit their circumstances in a way.
What sort of sense of purpose do you get out of that?
Yeah, huge. Like, yeah, it's almost makes it worth all happening. Not that it, you know, it's tricky to say that it ever will be worth what's happened to me, because who knows where I would actually be, what my life circumstances, and who knows what I could have gone on to achieve before that in any kind of work and workspace or life in that kind of sense.
It's tough living that with that what if.
Yeah, and that, you know, who might Lockie have been? Not to say I don't like who I am today. I love the opportunities and the life I'm getting to live now. But yeah, it always you think what might have been. Yeah, it's different now.
But you can be there for other people who are now where you were years ago, and you can make a massive difference to them and their lives. And what could be more meaningful than that, you could argue.
And that's it. That's the real benefit I get to see of it all in that kind of sense, is the shifts and changes I can have on people's mindsets. That early on, I'd go back to the rehab ward where I recovered from in the inpatient side of things. And there was a lady who'd fallen off a horse, who was a horse rider. She was aiming to be one of the first female jockeys to win the Melbourne Cup, but happened to fall off a horse, bumped her head, and was something she'd never be able to do again. And her family said she was struggling to see a light at the end of the tunnel, and what's life going to be after this now? And I walked in the room, and her first thought was, oh, here's another therapist. And I managed to share my story with her. And this is what I heard from her family later on, that after that first time meeting me, her perspective had shifted in a sense, going that there might be a life after here. Maybe there is something going forward and that kind of stuff. And hearing that from her family, after she left the rehab facility, and seeing her life going forward now and recovering, all the successes she's had, it's been really cool to think that I might have had a little bit of a turning point in her recovery to go, yeah, I can do this. And that's really cool to hear that. And that's been a big driving point to keep me going, to come back to visit people in these situations, in a sense, and share my journey, I suppose, like share the hardships that I go through and have been through.
Well, like you said, you'd never wish it upon yourself. And of course, you'd change it if you could, but you can't. But you can choose to do something with that for the better of others. And you do make that choice and make that effort, and it has that impact. And I just think when we find a way, no matter what it is and what's led to it, to be able to help others, and you can feel that, because you were there, you are there now. You can feel how much it means, and you have the power by virtue of what you've been through and who you've become to be able to help people in that incredibly difficult time. And that's powerful stuff, man. That's a reason to be here in itself. Definitely. And like you said before, you've got all these goals you haven't achieved yet. You've got plenty that you have achieved. You know, of course you have really tough days, and then you have some days, I imagine, where you forget about it for a while, and you're smiling and laughing, and you know, you've got that big smile on your face. So I think you are a great example to people who have just gotten one of these injuries, that life can be worth living, and you can have as catastrophic injuries as you had, and you can still get to a point now where, as hard as it is, you're excited to live your life, and you get a huge amount out of it. And that's after something so horrible happens to you. I'm sure that was the goal.
Yeah, you know, definitely. And in a really cool way, I was early on in my recovery, very early on, working hard at the gym, like I say, twice a day. And people at the gym go, "Oh, you do so cool, work so hard at the gym, Lockie. You must work really hard at your job. What do you do?" And I had the chance to tell my car with a car crash, and they said, "Oh, wow. Your story, you spoke so well, then you maybe should do sharing or speaking in that kind of sense in the future, and share your story. You might be able to motivate people in different ways." And I thought that'd be a really cool thing to do one day when the opportunity came up. And I was telling my uncle about it, and he works in the fire department, and they do a program called RAP, the Road Awareness Program, where a firefighter goes out to year 11 students predominantly around schools around the state, and shares a day in the life of a firefighter. Because
and they stage the car accident as well sometimes?
Not so much anymore. I got a little bit too time costly to get a car at every day.
I remember that from school though. Yeah. It was just such an impactful thing. Yeah.
So yeah, they say the day in the life of a firefighter, because I think 80% of their work is going to car crashes, and the firefighters are sick of cutting people out of cars. And the best way of trying to do it is, you know, telling people about it. And so I come in at the end and share my car crash story there. And that's been an amazing opportunity. And I've loved that to be able to go out and do that. And after every speech we do, the kids fill out a form and they say how they were before and how they want to be better going forward. And then they have to write a few notes down at the end, so tips and tricks that they took away from it or some nice words to the presenters. And that's been really cool to have those messages from those kids. And even adults have done a lot to different adult presentations and different sporting groups as well. And having those kind words from them saying, thank you so much, it's helped me shift my perspective on the road, because they don't want to cause that kind of pain or suffering to themselves or others and their families and friends when the recovery.
And who knows what the true impact of that is, and who you saved, and who hasn't been looking at their phone when they're driving because they saw you give that talk. You know, yeah. That's tremendous impact that you make there. And you are so articulate. You wouldn't know you have a brain injury. You're such a good communicator. And obviously it's a big passion of yours as well, trying to find channels to be able to do this, because it gives you that feeling of really helping people.
Definitely, especially early on. Like I said, seeing a speech pathologist for the first 4 or 5 years of my recovery, where people have to ask you to repeat yourself over so much, and because I'd often speak very fast and slimmer words because I get excited. So it's something I'm a bit more conscious of and trying to slow it down and speak clearly now. And yeah, that's why I'd love to get out and do that more, sharing in a way, in that kind of sense. And I was very fortunate. I got a chance to go to Darwin last year and speak at Street Smart High up there in front of all the year 11 students of Darwin, of, I don't know, 1,500 people or so, and share my story in a positive way to help them be safer on the roads, that kind of sense. And I was fortunate enough I get to help out around the Adelaide version as well. I'm not much of a speaker there, but in the half time the kids are all going around and seeing the stores, that kind of stuff. And in the fire department, we've got a dog and a dog suit kind of thing. So I get to jump around in the dog suit and dance around in there for a bit of fun. And so that's a cool different side of it that I get to do a bit more fun too. So
yeah, awesome. Yeah. So there are some really good opportunities there, and definitely. I obviously have some fun doing that and really help people too. So that's, and you started your own cricket league as well.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. So one of my goals was to get back into community sport after my car crash. And so I was very fortunate. My cousin played cricket here for the Woodville Rekabites. So I went down and started playing with him, and I think now this is probably my 8th season playing since my car crash, which is really cool. I'm enjoying that. But then on the side of that, I had a coop coach who was helping me train to get a bit better, to keep up with all the average or the uninjured people in some sense. And he said, I've got a lot of other people out there who have had disabilities and injuries that don't quite fit into the average cricket leagues. Would you be able to help me try and set up a cricket league so we can have this avenue for everyone to play in? I said, I'd love to. And so we reached out to a few cricket clubs, and we got Goodwood on board, Ranella Cricket Club, and we got Parra Hills as well, and started the Adelaide Inclusive Cricket League for people of all kinds of differences to come in and have a go at playing cricket. And it was really cool to get it off the ground last year for the first time. And this is our second season coming through now. And that's been an amazing, amazing thing to be part of. And the fulfillment you get from that and the joy, because, you know, you see the smiles on these people's faces who have never fit in the community in a sense, or been able to hold a ball or a cricket bat in a way and do it with a club in a sense. And we got the full kits of colours and coloured uniforms, that kind of stuff, and feel like a real team. And it was really, really special to be able to have that opportunity to do that and see the smile on these people's faces.
So you give people a community that they haven't had. And you, as I understand, having community just means everything to us as humans in general. And if you don't have a place to belong, it's so hard, and it can give people so much for their lives. So such a cool thing to do, to make happen, and not just have the idea but actually turn it into a reality as well.
But either way, it's been a really cool opportunity, and I've loved it. And like I say before, I played rugby union. I used to train four or five nights a week, and I'd coach with the junior side too, and that community was really a good part of it. And after my crash, I didn't have that community and sense around to get into. So that's when I have had the opportunity now to start that and show other people this kind of space and create it there too. So it's really cool, and I feel really, really proud and happy to be a part of it.
Hell yeah. It's such an achievement. You've rattled off quite a number of really cool things that you get to be a part of, that you've had a big hand in making happen. You gotta be proud of that. You gotta be happy with that.
Yeah, I'm very I'm good at coming up with ideas. And the hardest part, I suppose, I've got a lot of the frontal lobe damage in my brain, so I'm not very good at putting things into steps and making them go forward. So I'm good at having an idea and talking to someone, and that person goes, oh, cool, let's make that happen. And so, like,
you need some help.
Yeah, a few years ago when COVID first happened, Brain Injury Awareness Week, everyone gets together and the brain injury community has a group setting together. I thought, oh, it's going to be different this year with COVID, not going to be able to get together. So I reached out to my friend, Lauren Spear, who's a really, really awesome lady I've met over the time, who's started up her own brain injury support group of the Orange Butterfly. And so I reached out to her and said, hey, Lauren, COVID's going to be making Brain Injury Awareness Week harder this year. Why don't we try to do an online version of it and make a website of this all? And you're pretty good digital side of things. And I know people can get stories out of people. So let's come together and make this together. And so we made a website. Was it BIAW Brain Injury Awareness Week 2020? .com, the website in a sense, and it had a story of all different people's brain injury stories of the life beforehand, injuries that's changed it, and then the newcomers of what they've managed to do and achievements in a sense of
I reckon I might have even seen that website.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I have a former guest, Ed Fowler.
Yes,
I had on the podcast, and I reckon I saw his story on that originally.
Awesome. Yeah. So we reached out to him and got him involved as well, and a handful of other different motivating stories that were found because I had that chance to get out in the community through Brain USA and speak to people and hear all these cool motivating stories. But I know everyone doesn't always get to do it. So I'm like, how can I make a way that everyone can hear this story and get the same motivation that I have? And Lauren helped me with that website. So
you're a real connector, man.
Yeah. I like to try and give other people the same opportunities that I have had in a way because, I like to think of, I like to try and give people equal opportunity because a lot of time, especially in our sector, I suppose the disability community in a way, a lot of times people don't always get that opportunity or that chance or get overlooked in a way. So, and me, not to say I'm not in that community, but a lot of time when you first see me visually, I would not fit in the disability community. You think, oh, there's a normal average looking person.
In the gorgeous beard community.
Yeah, right. And so that fits out really well in that sense. People just go, no worries, and talk to me in that sense. So I have the chance to bridge that gap in a way. And then, then I can start talking to people and go, oh, how about this in the disability community? I mean, you hear about this kind of way and start shifting people's opinions and views on different stuff in a lot of different ways. So I feel very fortunate in that way that I get to do that.
What have you made peace with now that you were nowhere near before?
What was my life to be? I've made peace with that, I guess. I'll never play rugby union again. I'll never be a diesel mechanic again at professional levels like I ever wanted to. But my life is still pretty good. I've got an amazing new partner that I've met playing competition eight ball early on in my recovery to think about how hard it's put a white ball and a coloured ball in the pocket. So I managed to do it after a brain injury and that sense of good recovery for me. And then over time, met my partner doing that. And then we've been together now 8 years. And it's really, really cool new step. We just come back from the doctor just before. I found out that she's going to be pregnant. Oh, she's pregnant now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's only found out about an hour or two ago.
You're going to be a dad now?
Yeah. So that's going to be a new kind of cool, exciting opportunity in my life as well, which, for a long time, might not have thought was going to be possible in a sense, I suppose, after all the deficits I've had in a way to support not only me, but someone else. But my partner's been really fortunate. It really made me feel very fortunate in a way that I have the support around me to do these kind of things. And she's enabled me in so many ways. So that's been really, really cool to hear about that just before. So that's exciting.
Beautiful, man. Congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you.
Going to be a lucky kid.
Yeah.
And if it's a boy, he's going to have some serious beard genetics.
That's it. It's going to be interesting, that's for sure.
So just to finish off on, a lot of us take our health and our safety for granted because we just assume that tomorrow is going to come and our health's going to remain the same. Have you got a take on that?
I don't know, just trying to look after yourself. And so it's keeping mobile has been a big part, exercise in the community too, and Enable Fitness and Ross at the gym and that kind of stuff been a big part of my community to keep me moving as well and keep active.
And I suppose for people who are listening who are able-bodied and might be on a roll and everything's gone real well, of course we hope that it's going to continue that way and people can actualize whatever that path they're going down that they want to keep going down. But you're an example of how things can change in an instant. And ideally, of course, we'd love to avoid those incidents, especially things like car crashes, car accidents. So I suppose it's just for young men in particular, especially around that age where we think we're invincible and everything's generally going real well and we're all pumped up full of testosterone and bravado. Yeah. It's just not knowing that actually, no, you're not invincible and just looking after yourself as best you can and getting through those times.
Definitely. Yeah. And yeah, try and look after yourself and look after your mates too in that kind of sense. And don't be afraid to reach out to them and ask the questions just because they might stand up, put on a brave face all the time and this big, brave bravado front kind of thing. Don't be afraid to ask them and how they actually are going sometimes and try to be raw and emotional and real with each other, kind of thing, and always brave and a man in a sense. Kind of be a real man and share how you are with your friends.
Beautiful. I love that, man. Well, dude, thank you for sharing your story and thanks for doing so much in the community.
Yeah, thank you.
I think everyone says inspiring. It is. It's just beautiful to see someone who's been through what you've been through doing what you're doing now. Being so passionate, having so much to live for and strive for, and just having that event be part of your history and part of you, but it hasn't stopped you either. And you've got a great life ahead still. And I think that's just such a positive takeaway, especially for people who are in that position.
Definitely. That's what I found. Just trying to, no matter what the negative situation is that I have in my life come across, I'm always just trying to find that positive from it. So even, you know, having those negative parts, whatever it is, and just going to bed at the end of the day rather than going on the negative thought, try and pull that positive thought out of your head and whatever it was, I had a good day with this part here, or whether the tea in the morning was good or my breakfast or my dinner or something, try and have one positive to go to sleep on, and whether you write it down, have that bit of gratitude you can go to bed on, always helps me to go into the next day sometimes.
Just focus on that.
Yeah, positive. Always find the positive outcome somehow, or one positive little bit out of it and you'll be on the way up again.
Good advice, man.
That's it for this episode. If you like what we're all about, support us by following Youngblood Men's Mental Health on Instagram and Youngblood Mental Health on TikTok. Every podcast episode is recorded in professional quality video and they're all up on our Youngblood Men's Mental Health YouTube channel. So please show some love and subscribe. Thanks to our local business supporters, Herd Financial. You can find everything there is to know about the podcast at youngbloodmensmentalhealth.com. And most importantly, please share these stories with anyone in your life who needs to know they're not alone. We're all in this together. Catch you next time.